So each time I review, is this harmful or is this beneficial? What's my intention here? So the time that I handled money just to buy an iced coffee when I actually didn't need one, nah, that's just going over into greed. You didn't need to do that. And so I resolved not to do that again. So you can see it's like this constant reviewing. Is this working? Is it not working? Making my mum get out the car to pay for petrol, this is not working. Buying an iced coffee when I pay for petrol, that's going too far. Right? So trying to constantly review what's beneficial, what's harmful. Now I have an anagarika, so she's in her 30s. Can I ask her to get out the car and pay for petrol? Yes. You know, these kinds of things. So slowly, slowly just finding my way, and as time goes on and I'm getting more and more support, then it's becoming more and more easy to keep to retake up the extra rules again. But I think it's not unlike the same thing that regular non-monastic people have. It's like, oh, well, I'm now in this situation. What is beneficial? What is harmful? And it's because only you know your context and circumstance. That's why the Buddha says we have to make these calls for ourselves. And it's a refinement of discernment without judgment. Right? So we have to make a judgment call, but without the judgment of this is good or this is bad. And if I'm bad, then I better get up a cat of nine tails and beat myself. No, none of that, you know. If you got it wrong, well, you tried. And we'll do it better. You know, like I got it wrong when I bought that iced coffee. That was the wrong decision. What does the Buddha say in the Vinaya when I make a wrong call like that? He says, did you know that it was wrong? Have you worked out that that was wrong? And I'm like, yeah, I've discerned that. What didn't work? Are you going to not do that again? No, I'm not going to do that again. Very good. Carry on. Yeah? That's the way it's phrased. Like in the Vinaya for the monks and nuns, apart from the parajikas, you know, where you're just not monk and nun anymore, most of the rules, it's like, don't do that. Did you know that that was wrong? Well, I'm not sure that it was. Well, if you don't confess it, they can't do anything. But it's like, oh, look, I did this wrong thing. I now realize it's wrong. So you realize it's wrong? Wrong as in not beneficial for me to do that. So right and wrong is the right way to Nibbana is right, and the wrong way leads away from Nibbana. So indulging in desire for iced coffee leads me away from Nibbana. Helping out my mother by driving her to her podiatrist appointment, I think, leads me towards Nibbana. It develops that kindness. At least I think so. I could be wrong. But when I look at the effect it has on my heart, then there's the next thing. What was the effect on my mind? What was the effect on my practice? Now I did that thing. Now looking back, how, like, for example, here's the state of my mind now. Then I watch the news. What's the state of my mind at the end of watching the news? Is it more peaceful, more happy, more kind? No, it's not actually. At the end of watching the news, my mind is more agitated, more distressed, and less peaceful. So the result of watching the news having done a before and an after review. Before the news, my mind was in this state. After watching the news, my mind was in that state. And my mind was in a state that was less wholesome afterwards than it was before. So I then thought, well, I'm not going to watch the news. And then people said to me, oh, if you don't watch the news or read the newspapers or look at it on the internet, how will you know what's going on? And I went, why do I need to know? How does it help my practice? How does it help me benefit the world? How does it help me give more kindness to the world to watch the news? It doesn't. Well, you know, how will you know what to help? Well, no, I do what I can do. And if something arises that I can do something about, then I'll do something about it. You know? I get the regular, you know, vase petitions. My name's on those petitions. I send letters to my MPs about things. You know, if an issue is quite important, people tell me about it, and I do something about it. You know? Enough people around me watch the news. I hear what's going on. I don't need to do that to my mind. You know, my mind's a precious jewel, so I protect it from those negative influences. Does that make sense in terms of sila? So part of it is this wholesome, is it unwholesome? And then what is the effect on my mind? What is the effect on my heart? What is the effect on my life? What is the effect on people around me?
Like if you're trying to help someone who has a lot of negativity in them, that has a negative effect on you, but then helping them has a positive effect. It's like really those kind of things. You just have to look at overall effect. Is that the sort of thing?
Well, you know, in terms of helping someone with a lot of negativity, I come across that a lot in my own work. And you have to do it without attachment to a result. Right? If you have attachment to a result, then you are not giving, you are having a transaction. Right? A gift is given without expectation of something in return. So if you're trying to help somebody, you need to do it without expecting that it will necessarily have any effect. It might, and then again, it might not. And that's where the equanimity comes in. The equanimity about a result. So we have the good intention to make a contribution. We offer them some jewels of Dhamma, of wisdom. We do our best to help them understand it. And then if they're able to take that on and work with it, we are joyful. If they're not able to take that on and work with it, we respect their free will, their choices, their autonomy, and go, okay, that's the way it is. And it may be that with some people, after you may persist, or you may choose to work with someone who's able to accept that. If someone doesn't want it, or can't accept it, or can't take it on, or maybe they can take on a little bit, and that's as much as they can take on right now. We are joyful that they are able to take on that much. But if we're not attached to a certain particular outcome, then the lack of that outcome doesn't hurt us. If the outcome is other than what we would like it to be, And that's the way it is. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. I still love you. Even though you're horrible, I still love you. Whatever, you know. You are angry, you are what you are. And you're entitled to that if that's what you want, you know. I can't see a way that, because this does come up for me quite a bit in various contexts, you know, where I will do my best, but I have to be disengaged from the result. Does that make sense to you too? Because you would have that situation a lot as well, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Mm. And we shared before about the garbage with the hot water as well.
Yeah.
So people come in and dump all of the troubles and problems and ask me to take that, but at the end of the day, we should also let it go as well.
Let it go, yeah. And not be attached to whether or not they'll still have exactly the same troubles and problems next time we see them. That they're dumping their on us or they're sharing with us doesn't make that stuff ours. Doesn't make it our responsibility. Our responsibility is to do what we can do and let them be who they are. That's who they are. To have tolerance and acceptance that people are often not what we want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's bad enough with clients, but it often happens with relatives too.
Mm-hmm.
And their case never ends.
And do you think also an understanding of karma is important too, to appreciate that everyone does have their own journey and also the karma they have to live with?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the karma in terms of their choices,
mm-hmm.
right? That you may see someone making bad choices and offer them the suggestion that particular choice is harming them, that perhaps they might like to reconsider whether they would like to continue making that sort of choices because those sorts of choices are harming them. But have the understanding that these kinds of habits are really hard to break and that they may be victims of enchantment, of delusion, of not being able to see that their choices are causing them harm. They may not be able to see that. They may not be able to see what you're telling them. And that is their karma. That's their choice. And we don't have a right to take people's choices away from them, whether we agree with them or not. It's not our right. No. It can be really painful watching someone, like, metaphorically hitting themselves on their head with a hammer. You know, like, they go through their life and they've got this big hammer and they keep whacking themselves on their head and it's like, you know, if you would just stop hitting yourself on the head with the hammer, you'd have a lot less pain. And they're like, but I like my hammer. I like my drug addiction. I like my anger addiction. It lets me know I'm alive. And that's their karma. As in, that's their choice. We can offer them the information. We can offer them suggestions, but if they don't take it on, then we have the equanimity. And equanimity is, that's their karma, that's their choice. I am not them. And I've done the absolute best I can do. I have given them the most precious gift of Dhamma. It's entirely up to them what they do with it. It's so sad when they flush it down the toilet, but you know, there's nothing else to do. You can't send people to what is it they used to have in China, the camps where you had the reorientation of the mind camp. You know. Was that really compassionate, really? So.
Lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Exactly. When the Buddha was asked, will everybody get enlightened? Sariputta came up with the simile actually, and the Buddha really liked it. The simile of a city with a very tight wall around it and one gate, and the wall was so tight that no animal smaller, bigger than a cat could get in. And Sariputta said, we can't really tell whether every person in the world will come to this city, but every person who comes to this city has to come in through the gate. Right. So we can't tell whether every person in the world will come to Nibbana, but every person has to come through seeing and knowing the nature of reality. Whether or not they come through the classical Buddhist teachings or not. I mean, there are plenty of Pacheka Buddhas around. Pacheka Buddhas are people who work out their own enlightenment without ever hearing the Buddha's Dharma. So they worked out how to see the nature of reality for themselves, and they got to Nibbana.
Isn't it that they just didn't teach?
There's that aspect too, but they worked it out for themselves, right? So Pacheka Buddhas existed before, like they're frequently in the Jatakas, for example. Mm-hmm. So these are people who didn't teach, but they also worked out their enlightenment for themselves. So it's not that the Buddha's Dharma is the only way to Nibbana, but that the Buddha's Dharma is true whether or not a Buddha teaches it. Because he also said that, right? The Dharma is true whether a Buddha teaches it or whether a Buddha doesn't teach it. Truth is true. It doesn't matter whether you believe in gravity. If you step off a cliff, you will fall, you know? The gravity is true whether scientists teach it or not. Getting to Nibbana requires seeing and knowing things as they really are. So that's true whether you work that out for yourself or whether a Buddha teaches it. I'm not spiritually advanced enough to work that out for myself, but I'm glad enough to find the Dharma so that I get it from the Buddha, you know, so that's cool for me. Any more comments or questions? They're good questions, by the way. They're really high-quality questions.
I have some questions.
Brilliant.
About disenchantment, dispassion again.
Hmm.
Maybe you can explain about passion. Yeah. Some people feel that important to be passionate, to be truly engaged with a cause or an activity that you're doing. And when you're totally engaged with that, then you also lose a sense of yourself from that. And perhaps what the Buddha's talking about here is quite different, where there is a sense of attachment if things don't go towards to what your liking is. But that sense of attachment requires a level of, perhaps a level of reflection as well. Maybe you can just explain that a bit, like how is passion okay? for it's passion necessary. to do something effective for and what.
Well, maybe I'll talk about, start with attachment first.
Yeah.
Because you talked about that. And if I recall correctly, where I saw the Buddha talking about letting go of attachment was in terms of that attachment that leads to bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, and kama tanha. So he didn't actually say to let go of all attachment, but craving for kama tanha, craving for pleasant sights and smells and activities, right? That craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence and craving for non-existence. They're the types of attachment or the types of craving that leads to staying in samsara around and around. So it's very specific in terms of what kind of craving needs to be let go of. Kamha tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence, whatever that means. So in terms of this sequence where we're talking about seeing and knowing, disenchantment, dispassion, the specific type of passion it's talking about is the kind of passion that arises from enchantment through not seeing and knowing things as they really are, right?
Yeah.
The kind of passion that arises from delusion, from distortion, from lack of understanding. So it's a specific type of passion.
Sure.
It's not necessarily all passion, because the Buddha clearly had a lot of energy for the Dhamma. Perhaps in English we might call that passion for the Dhamma, right? A lot of teachers have passion for the Dhamma. But this is not the kind of passion that arises from delusion and not seeing things as they really are. So in turn, because of course English is a language you're going to be careful about, because the Buddha didn't speak English. And English is not a good match as a language for a lot of the concept spaces that the Buddha was talking about. So I'm not sure that it necessarily means in terms of dispassion that all kinds of passion are disallowed. So when you see clearly things as they really are, and you find yourself moved to do beneficial actions, and you have a great deal of energy arising and a great deal of determination arising, right, in the pursuit of those beneficial actions. I think we might call that passion for what you're doing, but I don't think it's the same kind of passion that we're talking about. I must have that sports car, right? It's like in English, we use the same word love, for I love my mother and I love pizza. But when I say I love my mother, it does not mean I'm going to sprinkle her with cheese and put her in the oven, right? These are very different things. I promise you I will never sprinkle my mother with cheese and put her in the oven, you know? So I think we have to be careful with English, yeah? So I think when I say I love pizza, I probably, if I was being very careful, I probably would actually more say that I don't actually love pizza. Perhaps I should use it something else. I love Coca-Cola. No, I don't even love Coca-Cola.
Iced coffee,
yeah. I don't know. I love Thai curry. Meaning I have a great deal of desire arising in my lips and mouth and tongue for the taste of Thai curry if I know that's that today's dana. Particularly on a day that I know that Thai curry has been brought for dana, all this desire arises in my mouth. So that might be I love Thai curry. But I must say, that doesn't happen when I'm thinking of my mother. It's a completely different reaction. When I think I love my mother, I think, oh, I want to give her a big hug. I want to make sure she's warm and safe and that she has good food to eat. Yeah. I want to take care of her and make sure she's not lonely, not sad, not hungry, that she doesn't fall over in the night and there's nobody there to help her. That's what I mean when I say I love my mother. This is a whole different thing, right? So when we say we have passion for the metta center, right? I think that's a very different thing to saying I have a passion for motorsports. I really like watching fast vehicles belching smoke and going around and around in circles while people shout. Clearly I don't have a passion for motorsports. Say I have a passion for football, right? Means that, probably means rather more than I really enjoy watching scantily clad men chasing a leather air-filled bladder around a playing field while lots of people shout. It's probably not what they mean by passion for football, but perhaps it is. But saying I have a passion for helping people in need, I think it's like rather different, you know? And I have a passion for beautiful girls.
Would you say the equivalent in terms of the Pali translation of passion, are you talking about tanha?
That's usually, I think it's
craving, isn't it?
That's craving, yeah. And passion I think is possibly raga or something. I'm not quite sure what the Pali word is that they're using for passion. Mm-hmm. I'd have to go and look. I'm not Ajahn Sajjato. He would just know that.
Yeah. Well, you talked about tanha just now in the context of the Four Noble Truths. So, and I certainly understand where you're coming from, because tanha, it's this unquenchable thirst, right? Mm. And there's an angst to it, as opposed to the passion for the Dhamma practice. It's the complete opposite.
It's really different, isn't it? Yeah. And the unquenchable thirst for beautiful sense objects and sense pleasures is completely different to the passion for the Dharma, the passion to do good, the passion to be of benefit in the world, the passion to help people. I don't think that's the same thing. I see a different effect on them. So back to our discussion, if we look at the effect on the mind, the effect on the practice, right? So the effect on the mind of running after sensory pleasures, such as, I don't know, cars, football, boyfriends, girlfriends, iced coffee, Thai curry, whatever sensory pleasure does it for you, you know. And the effect on the mind of helping people, of running a charity, of running the mitra, of running the metta center, of giving Dharma talks. I think these have a very different effect on the mind, a very different effect on the practice. And if we take that before and after shot, you know, in terms of increasing tranquility, stillness, happiness, joy. I think if we're doing having a passion for our good works, we could say, yeah, actually, my happiness meter is going up. There was a study I heard of that was actually done in the 70s about happiness in England or something, and they found that so-called like worldly pleasures, your happiness goes up and then it comes back down to where it was before. Right? And in your life, if you only go through worldly pleasures, basically your overall happiness pretty much stays the same. It just, you know, you get something pleasurable, it goes up for a while and then it comes back to where it was. You get something unpleasant, it goes down for a while and then it comes back to where it was. And ultimately you go pleasant up and down, unpleasant down and up, and your actual overall level of happiness stays the same all the way through your life, pretty much. Whereas with spiritual practice, your actual overall happiness level can gradually increase. And your capacity for happiness increases. Your ability to be happier and sustain that new level of happiness increases. And I think that's what doing things like the Metta Center, the Mitra, charity work, being a monastic, it just actually increases gradually, like the gradual path, gradually your life becomes happier and happier. So if I look at now my base level of happiness, and yeah, there's up and down, you know. Some days I'm happier than other days, you know. But overall, in terms of, say, putting a line through the dots in a graph, you know, my overall base level of happiness is much higher than it was 5 years ago, when that was higher than it was 5 years before that. And if I look at compared to 20 years ago, it's hugely different, right? So therefore my spiritual practice is increasing this base level of happiness in my life. It's a kind of way, you know, the baseline where you go up and down from, you know. And I think that's a good place to look at these questions of what does this mean? Is that a helpful discussion of that?
Yeah, that's very good. Thank you.
So, are we running out of questions yet? Have we had enough?
I've got
another. I like good questions. I can ask a bad question if you don't mind.
Oh, bad questions are good. One for her, and then you have another turn? One each, you know. Pardon?
I'm sure his is far more meaningful and worthwhile.
Not necessarily.
So.
Yours last one was pretty good.
Speaking of passion, craving, and boyfriends, I knew it. But I thought, no, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt.
Passion, craving, and boyfriends, yes. The affliction of the young, ha ha.
Oh, the old but deluded. my question is, like, sometimes it's not just with those kind of relationships, but a lot of relationships are. There's like a mutual, the mutuality aspect of it. So it's not kind of just like giving like you would to a child, you know, or to a pet or something where you really don't expect anything in return. There is a conditionality and there is an expectation behind it. It's really hard sometimes. Like, you know, if you get annoyed at something because it doesn't meet your expectation, to know whether that's not being kind or whether it's like reasonable, or like, you know, it's not really such a pure thing.
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
Not a lot pure about interpersonal relationships most of the time. Even you know, between friends.
Yeah, there's expectations.
There's really expectations, and from what I see with people that have good relationships, and I have to talk about them because I never did. I only had failed romantic relationships, so I'm probably not the right person to answer this question. But when I look at people whose relationships are working in terms of giving them a wholesome context, they're pretty clear with about their expectations. And they're pretty clear about their boundaries too. So one partner might say, I have these expectations of you, and the other partner says, you've just crossed the line. I'm not prepared to actually accept that expectation. And so there's a negotiation process goes on of expectation versus boundaries. But if you don't have some way of negotiating it, because it's not always verbal, that negotiation. Not all partners. The partners I see that are successful in terms from the outside seem to have somehow magically negotiated that conversation. Goodness knows how. But eventually, when you see the ones that have been together 25, 35, 45, 55 years, somehow they've come to a shared understanding of boundaries and expectations. Somehow. Sometimes it's like they got used to that expectation was never going to get filled, get over it. And other times, it's like, they realize they're getting something else that they never thought they were getting. Sometimes they come to a negotiation of, and often I'm guessing that some of these negotiations are non-verbal. They kind of, some kind of dance goes on, emotional kind of dance happens between the two, and the more love and acceptance and compassion there is, the more acceptance that actually neither of us is perfect. And not only do you not have to be perfect, and he doesn't have to be perfect, and that kind of thing. That's really hard. It's never going to be perfect. That just doesn't exist. You could trade in this version of imperfect for another version of imperfect, but that's what you're going to get. Because everybody's imperfect. But it does come down to